Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly magazine of the performing arts. I'm David LaTulipe. This week we'll hear about the 23rd annual Kung Pao Kosher Comedy Specials from Lisa Geduldig and Wendy Liebman. You'll also want to get your dance shoes on, as we'll hear about Forever Tango's return to San Francisco from its founder, Luis Bravo. Also in the dance department, a unique blend of East-West combining Indian Katak and American Tap is at Z-Space. We'll hear from Rina Mehta and Michelle Dorrance about that. We'll also have a choral perspective of upcoming concerts involving the San Francisco Symphony Chorus with the Symphony and from a member of one of the chorus, John Vlahidas. So stay with us. Well, let's start with our dance shoes on. Indian Katak and American Tap come together in the West Coast debut of a riveting new work from Rina Mehta and Rachna Nivas, as well as from Michelle Dorrance and Dormeshia Sumbri Edwards, in a piece that renews, reinvents, and continues a conversation between the two art forms that began with the legendary collaboration between Pandit Chitresh Das and Jason Samuel Smith. It's called Speak and will be performed Friday the 18th at 8 and Saturday at 2 and 8 p.m. at Z-Space. And two of the creators of and performers of the work Speak are with me in studio. Michelle Dorrance is a recipient of the 2015 MacArthur Genius Grant, who recently appeared on Late Night with Stephen Colbert. And she was quoted in a recent NPR interview that she sees tap as the ultimate dance form, to be able to be a dancer and a musician at the same time. Welcome to you, Michelle.
Hi.
Rina Mehta is a Fulbright scholar who has performed to great acclaim across the U.S. and in India, and she also joins me to talk about the work that she's created.
Hi.
Good to have you. Well, who came up with the idea of combining these two art forms?
Well, as you mentioned, Pandit Chitresh Das and Jason Samuel Smith have been dancing together for 10 years now. Their first collaboration was in 2005, and the tap community as well as the Katak community have been very engaged with the conversation that they began. A few years ago, Michelle, Rachna, Dormeshia, and I began talking about doing a collaboration that was similar, bringing both the art forms together, but featuring female artists
in the
dance form.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh. We're really excited about this process and continuing to explore it through the performance, because, of course, there's choreography, but quite a bit of improvisation. So This is a really exciting project for all of us.
Well, both of these dance forms go deep into the history of each of these cultures. Maybe we can, Michelle, can you speak to American Tap?
I mean, honestly, as far as our American culture is concerned, not Native American culture, but our appropriated, American culture, tap dance is the first American dance form. It's one of the oldest American art forms, period. So, and it also, really, the history of tap developing in this country tells a history of, America in a certain sense, racial oppression and cultures sort of combining under hard circumstances to, an expression that is really powerful and of the people, literally.
Mm-hmm. And when did you first get involved in tap?
When I was like 4 years old.
Really?
Very early, yeah.
Uh-huh. And you weren't, so you totally geeked out to tap dancing?
I did.
Other people in your school ever involved in tap dancing?
Oh, no, for sure. I had an incredible mentor, Gene Medler, in North Carolina. My mother started the school I studied in, so I had free classes. And she's a ballet dancer and teacher, and I was not as adept in that realm. But I was very musical, and I think that's in part why tap dance was so drew me in so naturally.
Mm-hmm. Rina Mehta, Katak goes back
centuries.
So could you share with us, for people that aren't familiar with Katak, as I am not, what makes a Katak style of dance?
Yeah. So India has birthed an incredible number of artistic traditions. India has 8 classical dance forms, not one, but 8, and 3 distinct genres of classical music. And Kathak is one of the 8 classical dance forms, and it is what makes Kathak very unique is that it's one of the few art forms that's incorporated the influence of the Mughal culture that was brought to India by the Mughal emperors. So Kathak originally was an art form that was used to tell the stories of the great gods and goddesses. And the Kathakas would travel, much like the bards and minstrels of Europe, and they would travel from temple to temple telling the stories of the Hindu gods and goddesses. When the Mughals came to India, the art form moved into the courts. And in the courts, it evolved alongside Indian classical music. This is where Kathak developed a great deal of rhythmic complexity. It's where the body lines of Kathak changed. You started to see the dancers standing tall. You started to see really fast pirouettes. So the art form really evolved with this influence of the outside. During British rule, the art form went through quite a bit of a struggle as the British were working very hard to subjugate Indian culture. The art form had to go underground, really struggle for survival. So in the same way that tap mirrors the history of America, Kathak really mirrors the history of India and what India's gone through. Kathak is storytelling, it is movement, it is rhythm, it's percussion, it's music and poetry.
Mm. So speak to me about the musical aspect of it, and is Kathak used just a certain set of musicians? Are there interchangeable instruments that can be used for performing?
Yeah, I always like to explain that you can't separate Indian classical dance from Indian classical music. They're intricately intertwined, and you don't know one without the other. So Kathak is always performed with North Indian classical music. And although nowadays you see a lot of performance with recorded music, the tradition is to perform with live music, in part because improvisation is such an important element of the art form. So my Guruji used to say, yeah, in the early days, there was no such thing as rehearsals. You go on the stage, you meet the tabla player, the percussionist backstage, and you say, yeah, today I'm dancing in a 10-beat rhythmic cycle, and then you're on the stage.
Off you go. Yeah, off you go. So what will we be seeing let's first talk about how you're blending these together. Are the musicians common, or is it completely different music that's going to be used?
So we've been in an intense rehearsal process for the past week, I should say, and I had to leave and go back to New York to do a gig, and I came back, and the jazz musicians and Indian musicians are totally obsessed with each other, and we're honestly coming from our cultural background, which is jazz. We just had this conversation last night with our drummer and composer Allison Miller. She just said it makes us seem so loose as jazz musicians that we can adapt, to these things, and we don't necessarily have any rules because there are such complex rhythmic ideas inside of the, most all of these Indian traditions. So we're working, let's say, in a 16-beat cycle, but we're working in 9.5, or we're working in 2 bars of 7 and 2 bars of 9. No, that's what it is, 2 bars of 7 and 2 bars of 9 in a 16-beat cycle. Myself and Rena, who are sitting here, we're doing a duet in 9.5. That's not something I've ever done as a tap dancer, and a lot of the jazz musicians have never, explored this as well. So that we are working in these sophisticated rhythmic patterns, we're all so excited to be doing this together. So that's one element that we're really excited about from the sort of jazz, tradition walking into this project. So that's a big, blend is almost the wrong word. We're really like learning. I don't know. It's a great exploration.
I should point folks to the SF Weekly article where you're talking about having dancers count to 9.5 and the challenges that are there.
It's awesome. It's humbling.
So do you think that's adding a fresher improvisational aspect to your appreciation
Undoubtedly.
Of dance?
Undoubtedly. And we are actually like, there's certain vocabulary that's very similar inside of tap dance and Kathak. So myself and Dormisha, we're looking at them, we're going, oh, we could do a little crab roll, we could do a paddle and roll, we could do, so we're developing certain patterns based on the vocabulary inside of Kathak.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and the same.
I was going to ask, Rena, are you taking some tap into your
Kathak? It's very interesting because while I think while rhythm is the common language, the approach to rhythm is very different. And so seeing how Michelle and Dormisha might interpret a phrase, a musical phrase, it's a completely different approach than how I might approach it as a Kathak dancer. And so it's extremely eye-opening. It just broadens my base of the options that I have. And the technique, you know, they're wearing shoes, wear bare feet, and they have taps on their shoes. So the way they use their feet is extremely invigorating. So we're watching them do these things with their toes that we, you know, we don't go on our toes, but maybe we could.
You don't even wear shoes for the most part for a Kathak.
No, but the way they move their feet. No, but the way they move their feet is pretty phenomenal. So we're learning a lot. We're learning a lot, and the musicians, like Michelle said, are learning a lot, and they're enjoying the process. And I do want to just give a shout out to the musicians that we're working with, because we've brought three musicians from India. Two senior artists, Jayantha Banerjee and Debashish Sarkar, who have worked with India's top dancers, and a young lion, as Guruji would call him, Satyaprakash Mishra, on percussion. So nice. We've worked very hard on the Indian side to bring in some very, very special and renowned musicians to join us.
And jazz musicians are absolutely top-notch. I can't even explain it to you. This collaboration is so exciting. Alison Miller, someone that I've worked with, on a number of different projects, one with Toshi Regan. And Todd Sikafoos is someone I used to sort of see. I'd go see Ani DeFranco concerts, and he was playing with her, but he's well-known in this jazz community. Carmen Staff, incredible pianist. So we have the jazz trios. Like, this collaboration is very exciting.
Fantastic. That's Michelle Dorrance. She's here with Rina Mehta to talk about Speak at Z-Space. Three performances only, Friday at 8, Saturday at 2 and 8 p.m. That speaks to me to say, does this project have legs? Are you going to take this elsewhere? Where else is it going to go?
We would love to take it elsewhere, and we have plans. We would love to do shows in New York and L.A. Pretty soon in 2016, and definitely we're looking to take the show internationally to India as well as Europe.
Well, best of luck with that, and I hope to catch one of the performances this weekend. It sounds like a fantastic combination of amazing dance and some pretty extraordinary music combined.
Thank you.
Z-Space presents Speak. Z-Space is at Florida Street in San Francisco, as I mentioned, Friday at 8, Saturday at 2 and 8. If you go to zspace.org and click on the New Work tab at the bottom of that page, you can get some more information about that. Thank you both for coming in today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Touch of some of the intricate rhythms you might hear this weekend as Kathak combines with American tap at Z-Space. Speak is the project. Zspace.org for more information on those three performances this weekend. I'm David LaTulipe. More dance to come. We'll hear about Forever Tango's return to San Francisco. We'll also hear about the Messiah performances at Grace Cathedral, as well as here at Davies Symphony Hall here in San Francisco. Joined now by Lisa Geduldig, who presents the 23rd annual annual Kung Pao Kosher Comedy Special, Jewish comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant, Thursday the 24th, the 25th, and then the 26th. This year it's going to be at the New Asia Restaurant on Pacific Avenue. Lisa, welcome back to our lovely KLW airwaves.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
23rd annual. This is a formula. This seems to be working. What can we say? Huh?
Exactly. When the idea came to me in 1993, it was a joke because I was performing at what I thought was going to be a comedy club in Massachusetts. I got there. It was a Chinese restaurant. I was telling Jewish jokes, and the rest is history. Jews go to Christmas, spend Christmas in a Chinese restaurant, and then go to a movie. So came up with an idea of, based on that, on having Jewish comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant, and I had no idea how to produce an event or if it would fly, and it flew. And here we are 23 years later.
Amazing. I mean, so the lineup has changed throughout the years, depending on availability, I imagine?
Depending if people are alive or not. We had Henny Youngman for his last show ever in 1997, and then he got sick that week with a cold and turned into pneumonia, and he died a couple of months later. So each year we have a different lineup. Occasionally we have a repeat performer. This year we're very lucky to have Wendy Liebman again, who was with us 5 years ago. And then the other two performers besides myself are new, Dana Eagle and Mike Fine. So always try and mix it up with a mix of people from all over the country, male, female, straight, gay, everyone's Jewish, people who have been there before, and newcomers.
Well, we're going to be joined shortly by Wendy Liebman on phone, but I'd ask you to stay throughout the hour and just chime in with some additional guests that are coming on.
Absolutely. Ask my eighth grade teacher. It's what I did best.
All right. Well, give us a little flavor of what we're going to see at Kung Pao, could you?
Sure. Well, a few years ago, I got a call from my box office saying that they had a patron who was going to be attending with a service animal. And I said, sure, I love dogs. And she said, actually, it's going to be a rooster. So this woman had anxiety and somehow figured out that the animal that would most calm her anxiety would be a rooster, of course, because that's a very calming animal.
Naturally.
And she promised that the rooster, whose name was Vern, wasn't going to make any noise, but someone laughed, and then the rooster went off, and I had to escort her to the door, and I said, I thought you said Vern wasn't going to make any noise, and she said, well, when people laugh, the rooster goes off. So somehow she decided to bring a rooster to a Chinese restaurant, and it got out alive.
Oh, I was going to say, the challenge.
So we just celebrated our annual Hanukkah, and as you can see all over the streets, we have menorahs strewn everywhere. Sorry, we do that after our holiday is over. But one thing I want to stress is that you don't have to be Jewish to attend, because basically we all have the same mother. It's like same guilt, different dumplings. So, everyone who attends has different cultural aspects that they've grown up with that can be understood no matter what their culture is.
More with Lisa Gedaldig shortly, and we'll be joined by Wendy Liebman after we talk a little bit more about some dance that's going on here in San Francisco. Tango celebrates the passionate music and dance of Argentina with six world-class Argentine tango couples, as seen on Dancing with the Stars. In addition, a traditional Argentine 1930s styles vocalist, Marcela Rios, and a 10-piece orchestra featuring the instrument of the tango, the bandoneon, 19th-century accordion. The original Forever Tango opened on Broadway in June of 1997, which was expected to be an 8-week engagement, but ran for 14 months. Its 92-week run in San Francisco set a record for that city's longest run of a touring show. And since 1990, Forever Tango has been seen by over 7 million people in North and South America, Europe, Asia, and Australia. The dances, performed to original and traditional music, are the result of a collaboration between each couple and my guest today, director-creator Louis Bravo. Mr. Bravo studied both guitar and cello as a child and in university, and has performed as a soloist with several major symphonies in South America, and was a member of the Argentine National Symphony until he moved to the U.S. Louis, Mr. Bravo, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you, Knight. Good morning, everybody.
I need to ask you, what made you transition from guitar and cello to tango, or do you still combine those wonderful art forms?
I do combine everything. I must have been 4 or 5 years old when I was studying both instruments, guitar and cello, plus some other instruments that are not mentioned there in my bio. But and then I joined the National Symphony Orchestra in Argentina when I was 19. I became the principal cellist at the Opera House at 21 at the Colonial Theater Opera House. And then I moved to this country, to the Los Angeles Philharmonic, when I was 23.
Wow.
And since then I've been here. And for the last 25 years I've been doing my production, Forever Tango, and with the success that accompanied me, you know, all this time all over the world.
Well, part of your motivation for doing this, no doubt, is to keep tango alive.
Who knows? Who knows? My motivation is it's just I like to do what I want, what I really enjoy, and I would say that the artistic creation is something very unconscious. I mean, you just do it, and as I compose music or I create choreographies or I do the lighting design, I do everything on the show. So It's what I do for life, not for living, for life.
Well, you must enjoy it then.
Very much.
Did you expect this to be such a huge success? I mean, this is some phenomenal numbers we were talking about in the introduction.
When you start something like this, you pursue a strong conviction. And when I decided to be to leave as an artist with four strings, I wasn't pursuing any success or anything. When I started to do my show or my opera or any other productions that I've made, I didn't pursue any success. I just did it. And thank God, in this case, the people loved it, the people liked it, and they gave me their confirmation. And I remember when we first came to San Francisco, it was back in 1994. We came for 5 weeks. We ended up almost 2 years here. And I built my second company.
That's just amazing.
Simultaneously in London. So I was traveling back and forth every Monday on those days. And since then, running two companies all over the world for the last 25 years.
Wow. Talk to me about your scouting process then. Do you personally select the dancers? Do you have people looking for people that are extraordinarily talented in tango to become a part of the troops?
Yes, definitely. I go to Argentina. I take auditions every 4 years, 5 years. It's a very painful process, in fact.
How so?
Definitely. You're looking for something that sometimes you don't know, and you have to be very careful, because you are dealing with human beings. It's not like just throwing colors on a paper or notes on
cattle
a pentagram.
Or horses,
yes.
Right?
You're dealing with human. You're working with their emotions and you have to find what they are not showing to you. So I think that's my biggest job. It's just to let them do what they can or they don't want to do it without noticing it. So that's definitely a director or creator job.
Is Buenos Aires still considered the center of tango, and to learn tango, is that where you would go? If you were saying, hey, you need to learn tango, you need to go X.
By far.
Yeah.
By far.
Uh-huh. How often do you get back down?
Oh, few times a year, but when I take auditions, I do it every 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm. There are three Russians in this current troupe, not something you'd normally associate with tango, Russian dancers.
It's because I think it's a very honest, I would say, contribution, because what I'm doing with them is a very European tango, a very European tango. And there is another piece that I play on stage myself with the cello. It's the second movement of a concerto for cello, bandoneon, and orchestra by Maestro Lisandro Drober, who worked with me for 30 years, something around. Mm. And they do it. They play those two routines. And what better selection I can have just to have two Europeans dancing the European tango, I think. And since, as I say, everything in art is about form, and I think I made a good decision and a very good selection in bringing this very successful and very good trained artist to perform a very European tango the way it was performed and danced back in 1910s when the tango reached the aristocratic salons in Paris.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak to us a little bit about the history of tango? What comes to mind immediately is Astor Piazzolla, of course, but he was also drawing on earlier melodies and rhythms. Where did all this start, and how has it evolved?
Well, I used to play with Astor. I played on the 70s, late 70s and early 80s. I played with Astor.
Wow.
For a long time. And in fact, I played with all his musicians. I was very lucky that I grew up in an atmosphere with very good musicians around and with fantastic creators and artists. The tango, there is a culture. Tango is a culture that has in the music its expression, and the dance is an interpretation of the music. Unfortunately, we are losing the lyrics when we play for people they don't speak Spanish. But even if they could speak Spanish, I think poetry is something that you cannot translate because it is a completely cultural charge. It's a very subliminal message in every poetry, and I think in a certain way in tango, the lyrics are given testimony of our culture and all the social and political changes that my country we had for the last 150 years. So, to understand an Argentinian, you have to be very, very, very patient because we are very unstable emotionally in every way. Because our history, we have a lot of, 80% of our families are descendants of Italians.
And all that explains it. That explains it.
And then we have a lot of Gypsy there. We have French. We have Jewish. We have a lot of natives. Everything all mixed together.
And that all comes through in the music, doesn't it?
Definitely. Okay. That's why the tango is so rich. It's so unstable emotionally. It has that drama sound that we receive from the canzonetta italiana. We have that internal sound from milonga, from the pampa, which is the native music from Buenos Aires. We have the polyphonic music that comes with the bandoneon, which is an instrument that was created to play Bach music. And then we have the Caribbean rhythms there that is as a result of all the heritage we receive from the slaves that came to work in the Rio de la Plata on those days at the end of 19th century. And then we have the Jewish music. We have everything there. It's a melted pot. And that's why the tango is such a beautiful and rich music in every way. And, of course, then after Astor Piazzolla, nothing was the same.
Yeah, interesting you should mention Astor and how wonderful that you worked with him. How is tango moving forward beyond Piazzolla? Is it more a preservation aspect of music that already exists, or is it something that anyone else is creating new, or are they just discovering the old?
We have to understand that tango is a living art, and it has the evolution of the people that cultivate it. Astor Piazzolla was in the music. It was such a strong personality and character that leave a trace that is totally. It's nothing was the same after Astor Piazzolla, and But I mean, you still have to go to the roots. And when you go and play tangos from the beginning of the 1900s or then the romantic era of the tangos, when Argentina was isolated from the world because we didn't join the Second World War, probably it was the most prolific time of in the poetry, on the painting, on the music and on all the arts in Argentina, because we didn't receive any influence from anywhere in the world. So Perón was on the power. So there was a very national, I would say, stamp in every creation in the country those days. Then the social changes after Perón in the 60s, and then the lyrics started to give a testimony of the changes, the social changes, and then Piazzolla, of course. And today, the tango is still, we are having a big evolution. We have a lot of people, young people, dancing and playing the tango. And there is a fallacy that tango is for all people. Tango is for everybody. It just is there. And our biggest composers, they passed away when they were 35. They didn't even reach 40 years old. I mean, in the poetry and the music and in every area.
So I imagine Piazzolla figures prominently in the current productions of Forever Tango.
Yes, we play some. Let me see. We play one beautiful song by him, "Adios Nonino," which is the song that he wrote for his father's death. Then we play "Lo que vendrá" at the finale. "Lo que vendrá" gives a question marks to the, I would say, to the future, because it means in Spanish when it will come. Mm-hmm. So, and we have two or three songs by Piazzolla.
Well, no exaggeration in the title, Forever Tango. It looks like it's going to be going for some time.
I hope so.
That's Mr. Bravo is the brainchild behind Forever Tango, now in San Francisco through the January 10th. Tickets at cityboxoffice.com. Mr. Bravo, thanks so much for taking some time today.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure. And thank you very much for your interest.
Forever Tango is sizzling back to San Francisco through January 10th at the newly remodeled Herbst Theater. Cityboxoffice.com for more information. Good afternoon once again. I'm David Latulip, joined now once again by Wendy Liebman, as well as Lisa Geduldig, to talk a little Kung Pao Kosher comedy. Wendy, are you there?
I am here. I was just listening to the segment about tango. I've been dancing.
We can see you. You look great.
I really did try to get on Dancing with the Stars at one point, because I've done the Macarena, the Hokey Pokey, and I once did a lap dance on my husband.
Oh, well, okay, let's not go there. This is radio. Well, maybe we can't see that. So you have been on America's Got Talent, though, so you're not doing too shabbily. What's your contribution to Kung Pao this year?
Well, this is my third time, right, Lisa?
Correct. Every 5 years.
Every 5 years, I get to come back. It's a Jewish tradition.
And I know, what is it with the Jewish stuff and numbers? You know, 8 candles and 5 years. What is, every 5 years, I guess.
18 All right. means chai, means life, means good luck. We're numbers people.
See, I don't know that much. I know my husband is obsessed with the number 8. And
put it on its side and it's infinity. Well, there you go.
Oh, I never thought of it that way. And I am obsessed with my age.
Is there an 8 involved in that?
No, there's no 8.
She's
right.
88.
Really obsessed. I think age is just whatever it says on your license, because I'm very immature, according to my pediatrician.
Well, that comes through right now anyway. So what? So tell me a little bit about the, what is it, sketch comedy, skit? Are you going to sing? What's going to happen on your end of things?
Well, I wish I could sing. I mean, I do sing in the shower, but only if there's a piano. And
that could be dangerous if it's electric, in so many ways.
Well, it's not an electric piano.
Yeah, I was going to say, all right.
But I do stand-up comedy, as do the three other acts on the show. Lisa's the, what do you call yourself?
The mistress.
Poobah, I believe it's
the grand poobah.
Yeah. She start. I'm going to just sing Lisa's praises. Speaking of singing, she started the Kung Pao Kosher Comedy. Is it 23 years ago?
Yes, this is the 23rd year.
And who was the first comedian? Was it Henny Youngman?
God was on the bill, Moses, Jesus, and one more.
Well, we know how that one turned out.
Yeah. but wasn't Henny Youngman on the show?
Yes, he was on the fifth year, 1997.
Wow.
That's the year that really put the show on the map. Kung Pao was written up in the New York Times the second year, but the fifth year when Henny Youngman was the headliner was the year that there was a big transition. And he's also claimed to fame the only performer we've ever killed. So that's pretty good in 22
what?
Years.
Well, you know.
Well, there's always this year.
I was going to say, depending on how you do, Wendy, I'd just watch your back.
Well, I do have to say the food at this restaurant, I know it's not about the food, but with the Jews, with us, it's about the food.
Well, is it kosher food as well as kosher comedy or not?
No. Any English major will know that Kung Pao, kosher comedy, kosher is modifying comedy.
Right. Not the food.
So the comedy is kosher, the food is not. But there's only one shrimp dish, and it's kosher. If you look on the menu on the website, it says kosher prawns. So that assuages.
So they feed it to us every night, and I can't wait to go back the next night. It's like addictive food for me. Well, I don't know about everybody, but it's just the most fun show. I've had the best. I actually petitioned to get this gig this year. In the past, Lisa has asked me, but this year I actually said, can I do your show again? It's so much fun.
Yeah, this year there was a bathing suit contest, and there was a whole bunch of competitions in order to be able to do the show again.
I do have a bathing suit. It's a bikini. It's a three-piece. It's a top, a bottom, and a blindfold for you.
Ba-dum-bum.
I can't believe I didn't get a laugh out of you.
Where's that?
Where, I don't have a laugh track or a drummer here. Sorry, Wendy. So what kind of crowds do I see on the flyer that you have an option of a veggie dim sum? That's could be a nice option.
Yes, we started the first year in 1993 with one show. It was just a dinner show on the 24th. And then each year the shows would get sold out, and I kept adding shows. So now we have two different options each day, either a 5 p.m. dinner show, which is a 7-course set banquet served to the table, or a vegetarian dim sum for the cocktail show. And it's not really cocktails, but I came up with that name years ago, and I feel like I can't change it. we used to have egg rolls, but now we have dim sum. And we also have Yiddish proverbs and the fortune cookies, which is something I came up with,
nice.
I think, the second or third year. And there's a little fortune cookie factory called Golden Gate Fortune Cookie Factory on Ross Alley around the corner from the restaurant. And it's this little sweatshop, shall I say. It's been there since 1962, yeah. And this wonderful woman, Nancy, and another woman sit there and just crank out these fortune cookies, and they generally make custom-made X-rated fortune cookies for people, and then once a year I come in and bring in these Yiddish proverbs and hope that the fortune cookies are not going to accidentally get mixed up and Mrs. Goldstein at one of my tables ends up getting some X-rated one as opposed to with one tuchus you can only dance at two weddings. So far it hasn't happened.
Or something like, you should call your mother.
Exactly.
That'd be a good one to throw.
There's all
there.
Kinds of ones, like if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a bus.
These are Yiddish proverbs?
Yes, these are all Yiddish proverbs, and each year I select 10 different ones. They're translated into English, and then we put them in the fortune cookies, and at the end of each of the shows, the audience gets the fortune cookies
I'm
with Yiddish proverbs.
I'm flossing.
Is this the same fortune cookie company that makes the misfortune cookies upon
I'm
request?
I'm not familiar with those.
Just like they have bad fortunes instead of good fortunes.
But you know what? Trying to find Yiddish proverbs that were not really nasty and biting are so hard. The ones are like, you know, may you, all of your teeth fall out but one, and may it rot.
Wait, that's a proverb?
Yeah, this is a Yiddish. This is our people, Wendy.
I thought we were good people.
We were, but we have a little streak.
Need a little work on that, I think.
Well, what's interesting is not until this year, I am Jewish, but we grew up with a Christmas tree, and I haven't really said that out loud until this year, because it's really the truth. It's we didn't celebrate Christmas, but we celebrated the festivity. And so I know you were saying before, Lisa, before the tango set break, that anybody can come to the show. You don't have to be Jewish. Well, you also don't have to be like the most Jewish. You could still be Jewish.
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 With a dash, right?
Yeah, we put a dash in the middle of that word.
Yeah, I mean, it's really just a comedy show for anybody who doesn't have anything to do on Christmas or the couple of days following.
Nice.
Or the Chinese Jewish couples who come. There's all kinds of different clients who come to the show.
San Francisco, anything goes.
Exactly.
Well, Wendy,
and I have family there, too, so they'll be there.
Wendy, we look forward to your appearances here in San Francisco. Where are you now, by the way?
I live in Los Angeles.
I've heard of that.
With my funny dog.
Nice, nice.
And
who will be opening for her?
Yes. No, you'll be opening.
Oh, right.
And my hairdresser is coming, so I'm very excited.
Excellent. Well, thanks for joining us by phone today.
Thank you so much for having us.
And Lisa, the show's at the New Asia Restaurant on Pacific Avenue. Partial proceeds will benefit the Legal Assistance to the Elderly and Institute on Aging's Friendship Line. That's a very nice gesture. Do the charities change from year to year?
Yes, every year. And it actually started the first year. There was a writer for the Jewish newspaper who I knew, and she was battling brain cancer. And at the end of the show, the first year, I mentioned that. And if anyone wanted to make a donation to medical costs, and suddenly I had $500 in checks in 5 minutes.
Wow.
And then decided after that to continue. The word tzedakah in Hebrew means charity, and it's sort of like charity with a sense of social responsibility. So each year I name two different organizations, whether or not they're health or AIDS or elderly or international, just a lot of organizations who do work that I believe in. I've given away by tens of thousands of dollars in the last 22 years.
Fantastic.
To different groups.
Keep up the great work. 23rd Annual Kung Pao Kosher Comedy, Jewish Comedy on Christmas in a Chinese restaurant is at New Asia Restaurant, the 24th, 5th, and 6th. Information at koshercomedy.com. Lisa, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
And now, as they say, for something completely different. San Francisco audiences have a couple of opportunities to catch Handel's Messiah. Tonight and tomorrow night, the final two performances of American Bach soloists and Jeffrey Thomas at Grace Cathedral with early instruments. And tonight, Friday and Saturday, at Davies Symphony Hall, with Ragnar Bolin conducting the San Francisco Symphony and Chorus on modern instruments. So choose your poison on that one, choose your honey, your delight in the music of Handel. My next guest, pre-recorded earlier this week, is a professional writer, producer, travel journalist, TV presenter, and former personal chef. He's been a co-host and co-producer for the National Geographic TV adventure travel documentary series Lonely Planet, Roads Less Traveled, and has authored some 26 travel guides for Lonely Planet. He's also a specialist in etiquette, food, wine, and lodging, has been a French-English interpreter, and is a member of Le Clef d'Or, the Paris-based union of the world's topmost concierges. So why have him on as an open-air guest? Well, if you're John Vlahidis, you've also been singing with the San Francisco Symphony Chorus for the past 15 years and will be a part of the aforementioned performances at Davies Symphony Hall, where I caught up with him on Tuesday. John Vlahidis, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, reading your introductory paragraph reminds me of a Tom Lehrer comment that he made at one point, saying, "It's people like you who realize how little I've accomplished."
Tom Lehrer also had a great line about sliding down the razor blade of life.
So. Which I think you're doing to its absolute fullest. Congratulations on that.
Thank you. I'm flayed.
Oh, you're literally all over the map. What is it about singing with the San Francisco Symphony Chorus that keeps you grounded?
What could be more grounded than singing, than using your body to produce the highest level of shaped sound with an august body such as the San Francisco Symphony, one of the world's great orchestras? There's nothing more grounding than breathing in and exhaling, which is what all singing is predicated upon. There is no singing without breath, and there is no grounding without breath. So singing creates grounding.
And then there's being a part of a larger ensemble that is also presenting this incredible music, I imagine.
The thing about singing with a chorus is you can never stand out. You have to blend. The blend is key to everything. So listening to your neighbor or the other musicians, you're constantly communicating and listening to each other and finding that perfect blend. So, I'm sorry, what's the question, though?
Just the joy of being a one of 100 or so, or however many in a group that is presenting this wonderful music.
The miraculous thing about singing with this particular chorus and orchestra is the musicianship is so fine, so high, that they're... How do I put this? When you make great music and everything is tuned properly, the overtone series line up perfectly, and their verticality is exact. And they continue to echo in ways you can't hear anymore, but they are still there. The sound waves are still there. And theoretically, they just keep going. So you're somehow tethered to the ethers when you're tuned perfectly and connecting with all the other musicians and doing exactly what you're supposed to do. And suddenly there's no more you in the equation. It's this bigger collective one. And that's the magic of the music.
You've been with the chorus for 15 years or so, having sung more than your share of messiahs, I'm sure. Most recently, the Beethoven Missa Solemnis as well. What have you seen differently that Ragnar Bolin is bringing to the equation?
Ragnar is a master technician. He insists on super fine detail. It's not just pitch. It's not just the verticality of the music, getting everything to line up. Ragnar's gift is in insisting we be, how do I put this, multidimensional, that we see both the verticality of the music but also the horizontality of the line. And that we always embrace the phrase, and that even though we're being technical about how we approach the music, that we never lose our musicianship either, and that we constantly hone and improve. Ragnar makes us better singers. He's a great conductor, and he has elevated the degree of musicianship so high. I can't say enough great things about him.
Back to the work of Messiah itself. In its early couple of decades of its creation, Messiah underwent many changes since first being performed in Dublin in 1742, largely dependent on what Handel had at his disposal for resources. Great singers at the time were incorporated, or things were adapted depending on the resources that were there. Have you sung different versions of Messiah with early instruments versus modern, or larger ensembles versus smaller?
I have limited small group experience with Messiah. I've sung it at a piano in a very fancy home before. I've sung it on the stage of the symphony. I've never sung it with period instruments. What I have heard it with period instruments. This is always a difficult question because Handel wrote this piece to be scalable. It could be very small, it could be very big. And at one point he performed it for, was it 80,000 people with 4,000 singers? Is that correct? Thousands and thousands. So this is an expandable or shrinkable piece. And what's wonderful about doing it at the symphony with modern instruments is there's a brilliance to the instruments, and there's a brilliance to this key that we're in because we're half a step higher with modern instruments. And this can be debated back and forth, and it's a topic best left to musicologists. But as far as what we have at our disposal here, a hall of 2,745 seats, which is a very big hall, and modern instruments and contemporary singers, the piece works beautifully for the hall, and it's an opportunity to hear all the subtleties that Handel wrote into the score because the musicianship and detail are so high. You don't hear... Most of us hear sing-along Messiahs. Most of us hear cobbled-together Messiahs, and we only on fine recordings hear the lush detail that Handel wrote into this genius score. By doing it at Davies Hall, such a big hall, almost 3,000 seats, with modern instruments that are half a step higher than Baroque instruments, there's a brighter tone, a richer resonance, and a big sound. I don't have a lot of experience doing it on the small scale, but I love the big scale, and you can see on the audience's faces that they do too. And it's remarkable that a 250-year-old piece, roughly, still brings in a packed house every night, and people sit at the edge of their seats as if it's new music, and they're completely connected to it. They're rapt.
This is like the Carmina Burana for Handel, or the White Christmas, in that I don't think there's been a year since its first performance that it has not been performed.
There was one that Ragnar told us about early on because there was disagreement between the librettist, Mr. Jennings, and the composer, Mr. Handel. And they fought over... I can't speak to that. There was one year in the 1700s when it wasn't produced. That's all I know.
Okay, so there's the inevitably popular Hallelujah Chorus, even though that's from the Easter portion of Messiah, with the also questionable practice of standing for that chorus, which is at once uplifting in many ways and exciting. I'm wondering if you have a favorite chorus.
It's hard to pick a favorite chorus because each one has a different effect. The more technically challenging choruses that have the 16th note runs, the digga 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 digga, all we like sheep, and he shall purify. Those are really satisfying to sing because of our technical merit with the symphony chorus. But the simpler ones they all have their... It's so hard to pick a favorite. I always love the opening chorus number 4, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed. Because it's deceptively simple, it's really hard to get that piece right. It's really hard to get it tuned exactly and to have the lilt. And this is Ragnar's gift as a conductor for us with this particular piece. He brings a lilt. You can imagine waltzing around the room to "And the Glory of the Lord." Most people sing it, "And the glory of the Lord." One, dun, dun, dun. Ragnar... Yes, you have to lilt, "And the glory of the Lord," and you swing. Handel actually wrote this, not "and the glory of the Lord." He put a footnote in his score that said, "and the glory of the Lord." So they were all single syllables. Everyone else sings it, "and the glory of the." We're singing, "and the glory of the Lord." So he's a purist. This Ragnar is a great purist in many ways. Sometimes he's often a purist. But more than anything, his presentation is regal, stately, majestic. And I think this opening chorus really shows that majesty.
Well, advice that was given to the charity concert for Foundlings Hospital in London could well apply to these performances, that due to the large crowd expected, quote, "the favor of ladies not to come with hoops this day, and that gentlemen were desired to come without their swords." I think that's excellent advice for Davies Symphony Hall as well.
I hadn't anticipated any drag queens in the house, but if there are any listening who are planning to come to Messiah, you will need a loge seat. You'll have to make arrangements with the conductors for your large hoop skirt.
Well, John, what's your next adventure, either choral or otherwise?
What's my next adventure? I am not sure. I'm healing from knee surgery, and I put everything on hold, and I have devoted all of my attention to music and art. So in that, I will find inspiration that will direct me, I'm sure. I write a lot of books for Lonely Planet. The travel publishing industry is in flux. I want to do something else, frankly. I don't know how to answer your question.
Well, Handel's Messiah is tonight, Friday and Saturday at Davies Symphony Hall, sfsymphony.org for more information. And if you want to read an entertaining essay about why you shouldn't take sleeping pills on a long airline flight, go to johnvlahides.com. That's John, VLAHIDES.com. John, thanks for taking some time with us today.
It's all my pleasure. And if you can't spell my last name, you can just Google Ambien and airplanes. I'm the first thing that comes up, I'm embarrassed to say. But wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me, David.
To whet your appetite for the oratorio of oratorios, here is one of John's favorite choruses from Messiah and the glory of the Lord. Trevor Pinnock and the English Concert and Choir there with that excerpt from George Frederick Handel's Messiah. American Bach Soloists does it on original instruments at Grace Cathedral. Go to AmericanBach.org for more information. The San Francisco Symphony and Chorus perform it in Davies Symphony Hall. SFSymphony.org for more information. I'm David LaTulip. This is Open Air. Thanks for listening. My thanks to Neil Swinkels for producing Open Air. If you have a segment suggestion, email me, david@kalw.org. And a reminder that all of our shows are archived at kalw.org, the Open Air page. Next week, we'll have a special concert performance of the New Century Chamber Orchestra, and I'll be host for Sarah Cahill this coming Sunday evening from 8 to 10 for 2 hours of new and classical music and revolutions per minute. Thanks for listening.